For this episode, we partnered with Needed, the leading women's health supplement brand recommended by nutritionally trained practitioners. Did you know that 95% of women who take prenatals are still nutrient deficient? Most prenatals are designed to meet bare minimum needs, not to optimally nourish you. We love that Needed's products are based on the latest clinical research and that they focus on care before, during, and after pregnancy. Support your body with radically better nutrition and save 20% off your first month at thisisneeded.com with code FDU.
You're listening to the Fertility Docs Uncensored podcast, featuring insight on all things fertility from some of the top-rated doctors around America. Whether you're struggling to conceive or just planning for your future family, we're here to guide you every step of the way.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Susan Hedson from Texas Fertility Center with another episode of Fertility Docs Uncensored. I'm here today with our co-host, Dr. Carrie Bedient from Fertility Center of Las Vegas.
Hey.
And Dr. Abby Evelyn from Nashville Fertility Center.
Hey, everybody.
And we are so honored to have Dr. Erica Bove, who is a reproductive endocrinologist at the University of Vermont and also the founder of Love and Science. And she is going to join us today to tell us about what she does and kind of talk about things like body image, relationships, those types of things, and how they affect fertility and fertility affects them. How are you doing, Erica?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
Good, good. I'm so excited to have you here. But I understand you had a little chilly start to your morning today.
I did. So I am in chilly Vermont where I take care of patients, and I also adore running. And something about the treadmill just isn't the same as being outside. I got the idea that I would go for a 5-mile run starting at the university and then going down the hill, you know, along Lake Champlain, which is absolutely stunning, along the mountains. And then I would then do it out and back, turn around, and then go back up to the university and then, you know, keep seeing patients. So it was kind of a, you know,
Dropping her jaw.
Yeah. And so, I mean, thankfully I've been running for 25 years. And so I have all the gear, right? So I have like the warm leggings that keep you warm, and I have the many layers of things. But the one thing that really got me yesterday was my hands. It was like -1 with the wind chill. It was like actually 14 degrees Fahrenheit. So I had these gloves, which are normally warm enough, but they weren't keeping my fingers warm. And so I balled up my hands in like the hand part of the glove to like spare my digits, which obviously I need for like embryo transfers and things like that. And I like, everyone was looking at me like, who is this person with like these, like, you know, it looked like there was something really wrong with me, right? And as soon as my hands got warm enough, then I like, you know, put my actual gloves on. But it was so cleansing and exciting, and I was so proud of myself, but it was a little kind of, you might look at me and be like, oh, she's a little different. Yeah.
So, Erica, I got to tell you, for my 3 years that I lived in Minnesota, I considered it an adventure, but I loved it because our car was in our garage before we left. And so that wasn't too bad when it was crazy weather like that. But, you know, your car sat in the parking garage with the wind blowing on it all day long, and it would be so, so cold that the vehicle really wouldn't warm up until you actually got home. And my hands would hurt so much that my husband started driving me to work because he didn't deal with grumpy Susan when I got home. It was better for him to like come and pick me up than for me to drive and be in pain and be gripey when I got home.
Oh my goodness. You got a chauffeur for 3 years. That's amazing.
Pretty good gig. Oh man. I can't imagine running in that weather, even with the most layers. And I'm in Tennessee and I used to be a runner, but even with a bunch of layers, in the wintertime, I would do the treadmill.
I'll send you guys a video later today. I took a video on the waterfront. It was so peaceful. But, you know, what's not captured in the video is how actually cold it really was. You know, it's pretty cold.
I have to say, the only time I've been to Vermont was for my interview for fellowship there. And it was beautiful, but it was like summer or early fall. It was fantastic. And I remember that kind of your pedestrian walkway where it has like all the shops and the cooking school and all those things. It was like out of a fairy tale, but you can keep your winters.
Yeah. I actually interviewed for fellowship in Vermont, and I remember coming there from the University of Florida in Gainesville, And when I got there, I think you guys were having a really hot stint of like mid-70s and everybody was just dying in Vermont. And I'm like, oh, this feels great. This is awesome. No humidity and it's coolish. And it was like 90% humidity in Florida, you know?
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
That's so funny. Well, let's do a couple of questions today. All right. Our first one is, I'm truly thankful for all the info y'all provide. I would be lost without you guys. Y'all are so sweet. I'm 44. Husband is 42. Already suggested donor eggs due to my age. Proceeded with a cohort of 6 eggs and husband's sperm. No PGTA due to donor's age of 28. Saline, genetic sperm testing all normal. 4 fertilized, day 5 transfer. No embryos, made it to blast. Best looks like to be a morula. Transferred, lining in all levels good. Checked remaining day 7, 1 made it to blast and was fair, quote, 1 BB grading. Transfer failed. We feel there's conflicting information about the quality. Not sure if we should bet on a 1 BB or start over with a new donor. Do donor eggs tend to develop slower after being thawed and fertilized? Any guidance would be greatly appreciated. Thank you for all that you do. This is a great question.
Any information about her husband's sperm other than it was just normal? Is that all she said?
It all sperm testing normal.
Mm, okay.
Well, one, I would say that just because you had a young donor doesn't mean you didn't have a 50-50 chance of that embryo being abnormal. And so I think that's definitely something to consider. I don't know if I would pay for PGT with 1 remaining embryo. Mm-hmm. Going into that, knowing that there's a 50-50 chance for the last one and there's a 50-50 chance for this one.
I mean, I think that there's probably a less than 50-50 chance if it's a 1 BB. I mean, that's...
Day 7, right? She said.
And it's a day 7.
Day 7,
yeah.
Yes.
Like, I think it's probably considerably less.
I was thinking 50-50, whether it's genetically normal.
Oh, yeah. The other thing that she asked about, do embryos take longer to form out of frozen eggs? The answer is generally, yeah. I mean, we find that it takes an extra day beyond what we would anticipate with using fresh eggs to get good embryos. And so when we have somebody who's going straight into a transfer, like no PGT, thaw the eggs, create the embryos, we say, okay, we're going to schedule you for a day 5, but you need to know there is a very high likelihood that it's not going to happen until day 6. Don't worry about it. That's very common. And so we give people a heads up, but I'm, you know, I don't know that I would push really hard for this 1 BB. I think it probably makes sense to try and get more embryos so that you've got that 1 BB as a backup if you need.
But if you're only wanting one child, I don't think I would spend, you know, $20,000 on a whole nother cohort because there's a chance.
Yeah.
I mean, but if you want more than one child and you have the opportunity to do another cohort, I think it makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder why they had kind of slow growth. I think if it were me personally, unless I really, really like the donor a lot, I probably would pick another donor. I mean, it's hard to know if it's egg related or sperm related. You typically think that donor eggs do a little bit better than that as a general rule. So I would consider maybe using a different donor next time as well.
It's always hard to find out when you're using a lot of frozen eggs, whether or not this is from the donor or is it from just that particular lot. I just got a report on patients who are using donor eggs, and it looks like that particular cycle, when we got the photos of the eggs, didn't look good at all. But she's a donor who's been through other cases and has done great. And so, you know, it's just that particular lot of eggs that kind of sucks.
Well, and one other thing too, I think we noticed there's at least one bank that we get eggs from and they're not real good. They usually don't have very good development from that particular egg bank. And I don't know what it is, but, you know, not everybody freezes the same and not everybody has good of a success rate
with
egg freezing.
Much harder than ever freezing.
And some banks have guarantee programs too, where they guarantee a good blastocyst and some don't. So I would look into what that is for the actual agency that they went through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another thing to think about is also how much your lab does with frozen donor eggs and specifically eggs from that egg bank. So all egg banks have certain policies and procedures as to how things happen. And if you maybe chose eggs from an egg bank that they don't use on a regular basis, they may not have as great of a level of expertise in warming those eggs as compared to eggs that they deal with on a regular basis too. All right, okay. Let's do one more. Okay, so hi there. I'm hoping for your expert advice. I just turned 39. My fiance is going to be 40 this summer. We have been trying to conceive for 6 months and recently had some testing. My ovarian reserve is good, 25 follicles, AMH 2.0. Transvaginal ultrasound showed everything looking healthy. The only thing was my blood work was that my TSH was 3.45. So my doctor put me on 25 milligrams, well, it should be micrograms, of levothyroxine a few weeks ago. Semen analysis was normal. My doctor is saying, given our age, we should go straight to IVF. Do you agree? Is it worth trying naturally longer or IUI? Thanks so much.
I assume they've probably already been trying for a year, though, or they wouldn't be there, right?
I think she said 6 months.
Okay.
6 months, and she's 39.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends on your goals. You know, like we've said before, if you really want to get pregnant at 39, statistically, you have a pretty high probability of having genetically abnormal eggs. And so time is not on your side. I mean, if you were 29, I might say, yeah, try a little bit longer. But at 39, I think if you really want to be pregnant, the quickest route to pregnancy and the most successful route is IVF. And I think that I would lean toward that sooner rather than later. I mean, probably wouldn't hurt to do something for 1 or 2 months, but I wouldn't tarry. I'd go pretty quickly to IVF.
Yeah, I think I would agree with all of that. Family planning makes a huge difference. Your tolerance for negative pregnancy tests, your tolerance for perhaps not getting the result that you want, that's very different from patient to patient. So a lot of it depends on what you want to do. I mean, when we're faced with the decision of, okay, you have one chance, the answer is almost always going to be IVF first because your success rates are going to be higher. So it just kind of depends on where you are in all this and what you're thinking and how aggressive you want to be from the get-go.
Again, if you want to have one kiddo versus two or three, that's a whole different ballgame.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right. Well, let's kind of get literally to the heart of the matter today. So, Erica, why don't you kind of introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up doing what you do now.
Sure. So my name is Dr. Erica Bove, and I'm a fertility specialist at the University of Vermont. And I also recently founded this fertility coaching practice called Love and Science, Thriving Through Infertility. And this was born out of my love of coaching personally, in terms of all the different ways I've accessed coaching to kind of up-level my experience of my own life, improve my relationships, etc. And then also really seeing a gap in the care that we're able to give to patients when thoughts, feelings, mindset, all of that, we just don't have enough time in the day to delve into it in detail. And so much of the time when I was looking at my schedule, a lot of it was patients who had bad news and they were trying to figure out next steps. And I was like, this is not, I mean, there is the science component of it, but that's the easy part that, like we just talked about, like the, you know, the hard part is, well, you as an individual with your background and your values and your goals, like, what is the right next step for you personally? And that takes time. So that's why I decided to combine my two loves, which are coaching and fertility medicine, and create this space for women professionals who are undergoing infertility treatment, who really just need some extra support. They want some community to really help them through the journey.
Neat.
That's fabulous. That's such a good plan. I feel like when we're counseling patients, a lot of it is, okay, here are your options. You can do any of them. And the right one is always which one is most appropriate for you as a human being or you as a couple, rather than what is the, you know, quote unquote, scientifically right thing to do.
That's so, right. Erica, how do you do that logistically? Because, you know, in our office, when we see patients, you know, obviously we do some of that, but you're right. We're limited by time and we can't delve into that. So is that like a separate thing that you do on the side, or is that something that you do part of your practice, or how does that work?
Yeah. So right now, my time is roughly split between clinical medicine and coaching. And so clinical medicine is a, you know, faculty through the University of Vermont, and yeah. I'm actually divorced. And so that's part of the story too, because I have like a week on, week off schedule. When I have my children and when I don't have them. And so what I've really decided that works well for me at this point in my life, and we all know it all evolves at different stages, yeah. is that when I don't have my children, I pour myself into clinical medicine, and I actually live in New York, and I come to Vermont and work for a week at a time. And I teach the fellows and I take care of patients and I do all that academic stuff. And then I travel back to New York and spend a week with my children and really delve into the coaching world. And as I was saying to Susan when we talked before, it's not always that black and white. Like sometimes I write, like, you know, finished patient notes, and sometimes I coach at night after I'm done with the clinical day too. But that's kind of roughly how I divide my time. And I really thought hard about whether I would combine the two, you know, whether mm-hmm. I would like
yeah.
carve out a nested coaching program within my faculty appointment. But yeah. I think that it just made a lot more sense to keep them separate so that, and plus, you know, I can now take care of people from a coaching standpoint in all 50 states, whereas I only have a couple of medical licenses, and that would really restrict the access for people
oh,
who
yeah, that's true.
Would want these services. So I have coaching insurance instead of malpractice. And these sessions are all virtual. They're very accessible. I try to find times when, you know, Friday nights are our support group, so people are generally free then. And it's just, yeah. it works really well. I even have a client in Bali, which is super fascinating because
wow.
she's a pathologist who lives in Bali. And so it's always Friday night for us and Saturday morning for her. It's just like super interesting.
That is crazy.
That is great. Yeah. It's great.
What are the most common questions and issues that your patients or your clients are bringing to you?
That's a great question. I think a lot of it is the feelings. And so, you know, we delve a lot in the hopelessness, the despair, the feeling that life has gotten so narrow and small. I have a lot of patients with a lot of fear around, well, patients, I guess I should say clients in this context, clients with a lot of fear about their upcoming next steps. Like say it's an embryo transfer and the last couple ones haven't worked. And that's all they can think about. They wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning with their heart racing and that's just consuming all their thoughts. Mm-hmm. And so it's really a lot of that is helping my clients with how to let go of the outcome, how to have authentic hope, which is one of my pillars, and then let go of the outcome to really align themselves with the best possible outcome.
So explain your pillars to us. That's interesting.
Oh, yeah. So compassion is one of them, right? Evidence-based is
self-compassion,
one of them.
Right? Self-compassion.
Self-compassion, absolutely. Yeah. Mindful self-compassion. We do a lot with Kristen Neff's literature, which is, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but it's absolutely fantastic. She's a PhD psychologist who's done a lot. And it's interesting how a lot of her pillars of self-compassion, which are, you know, self-kindness and mindfulness and also common humanity, infertility is so darn isolating, right? And when we can say like anybody in my situation would feel this way, I think it's a lot less you know, terrifying. So definitely compassion and evidence-based and authentic hope. You know, we really delve into, you know, what is authentic about your particular situation. We are not frou-frou false hope kind of people. We are like, oh, you are 26 years old. That is a reason that, you know, we can hang our shingle on that. You know, okay. You've had a kid before. You have 8 newborn embryos in cryopreservation,
yeah.
whatever it is.
There's a lot going like, for you. Yeah.
Because I think we lose sight of that. Like our patients yes. lose sight of that. Yeah.
I think that's really common, really common.
Yeah.
But sometimes you do see people that have like 4 embryos that are frozen and they're just devastated and rightfully yeah. so when it doesn't yeah. work, but you're like, but you've got 4 great embryos. You know, the chances of not getting pregnant with those 4 great embryos is really low. So it's good to have somebody to kind of put that in perspective to them.
Yeah. That's exactly it. It's like a change yeah. of perspective. And we always start our meetings with the wins. Like what, you know, what good thing happened this week, right? Whether it's a mindset shift or, you know, maybe somebody got fertility coverage and they didn't think they'd have it. Like whatever it is, we like start on that note. And then we delve into the content and we talk about the coaching. Like I do laser coaching for individuals. And I think it, even if somebody's not getting coached themselves, it's really helpful to hear other people because it's like, there's so many commonalities in the stories, right? And then we always end with the next right thing. So it's like, what is your next right thing? And we go around and everyone says their next right thing for the week. It's just so very powerful. But my 3 real true pillars are empowerment, evidence-based, and compassion. And then within that is holding on to authentic hope.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful.
How do you see that struggling with fertility affects different people's images of themselves, whether it's emotional or physical? How does that play into the whole process?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I think nobody leaves the infertility experience unscathed. I think it's a very, even if you pop in, get your evaluation, you're pregnant a couple seconds, cycles later. I mean, we know that our patients with infertility have similar anxiety and depression rates to patients with cancer. And that's we just know it takes such a toll on us emotionally and physically. And so I think in terms of, you know, the body image, I think that's something that we don't talk about enough. There's this like mind-body dualism, like the body is a machine. And what I hear from a lot of my patients is like, I feel like I have one focus. I have one focus and that's to get pregnant. And if it doesn't work, I'm a failure, right? Mm-hmm. And I always say like, let's take that word out of the vocabulary because if anything, our science has failed you. It's not that you're a failure, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's like people feel like their body is their enemy and not their friend.
Yeah.
And so part of what I do is I bring awareness to that, you know, in terms of like, let's figure out how to work with the body and use our science to augment whatever we need to, and then also drop into the body and do something kind to our bodies, for our bodies, with our bodies, in our bodies, whether it's a massage or a walk in nature or something very intentional, to be realizing like, my body is my friend. Yeah. You know, I am a vessel. You know, this is going to work. I don't know exactly when, but I got to stay the course. And then also like mitigating some of the side effects too, because we know that when people go through various treatments, they can feel bloating, they can have mood swings, they can, you know, I hear this from the husband sometimes, like, oh, I can always tell what's going on. You know, she gets kind of moody, and the patient's like, yeah, you know. So just trying to normalize some of that stuff. It's not you, it's the hormones, right? And also like weight gain and acne and just not feeling sexy. That's something I hear a lot. Just really trying to help people get into their bodies in a better way.
How does gratitude play a role in all that? Because, you know, there's lots of works written about gratitude and how you actively focus on more positive things. Like Brené Brown, I'm reading the book that she has out. I can't remember the name of it on the bestseller list, but she talks a lot about how gratitude forces you to kind of like change your way of thinking, and just changes your focus. And you realize that you should, you know, there's a lot of things that you have around you that you should be thankful and grateful for, but you don't even think about those things. You just think about the things that don't work.
That's right. We actually talked about that on Friday night, which is so funny that you said that, because there's this saying that where the attention goes, the energy flows. And there's also that mentality of, isn't it right? I mean, it's so true.
Yeah.
Where the attention goes, the energy flows. So if our attention is on, you know, our upcoming transfer and the fact that our brains tell us it's not going to work, right? Or if the attention is on, you know, just sort of not knowing what we should do and then ruminating, perseverating, like that is what grows in our consciousness. Mm-hmm. But if we can say like, okay, I'm going to take three, and I actually have a gratitude practice myself, so it's so cool that you asked this question. And we have data that it takes depressed people into less depressed. It takes less depressed people into, you know, sort of feeling kind of neutral. And it actually even makes happy people happier when we can be, so it changes brain chemistry, which is so fascinating. So sometimes I help people say, you know, what are you authentically grateful for? And maybe it's like that I have produce in my refrigerator. One person recently said I can afford raspberries. Like, that's an amazing thing to be grateful for. Or maybe it's like where I am in the world. Like, I'm so grateful I have heat and a warm home right now, right?
Yeah.
Or I'm grateful that I have my cat. You know, I have a patient right now who's waiting to have her embryo transfer, and she's such a great cat mom. She really is. And so, you know, we embrace that. And I think it's not just naming the things, but it's really savoring those things and like on a very cellular level, allowing it to change us. And that's where I think the brain chemistry changes, is when we can like really focus on those things. And then it's contagious. Then it's like, you know, even today I texted my gratitude buddy, like, these are my three. Oh, and this, oh, and this, oh, and this. I think I settled at like five, and I could have kept going, because once we get on that more positive train, and again, I'm not one for toxic positivity. Do not, you know, misunderstand, but this is like authentic gratitude, things that we can truly be grateful for. It's like, you know, maybe there's more right going on than not. And then it instilled belief in us that maybe the thing that we're hoping for the most on the fertility journey might actually happen, because we have evidence that there's other good things in our life.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just such a magical practice, and I'm obsessed with it actually.
Receptiva DX is a powerful test that can help detect inflammatory conditions on the uterine lining that might be preventing you from becoming pregnant or staying pregnant. If you've experienced implantation failure or recurrent pregnancy loss, ask your doctor about Receptiva DX testing. If found, uterine inflammation can be treated, providing a new pathway to achieving a successful pregnancy. Receptiva DX, because the journey's worth it.
So how do you coach patients where you've got one partner who is hopeful and is kind of in that positive MO, and the other one who is the polar opposite? Because I feel like that's a lot where
those are hard patients to deal with.
Who is all in and this will work, we'll just keep trying, it's fine. And the other one is like, this is never going to happen.
The negative energy.
Yeah. Like you can just, it radiates off of them. And so what do you do when you've got couples that are mismatched like that?
Great question. So I think the biggest thing, and actually my first module in the content, is on values and identity. Because when I meet with my patients for the first time in the clinic, I say, okay, who are you? Where are you from? How many kids do you want? You know, what makes you tick? Who are you as a person? And people find each other. I mean, they usually have shared values. That's part of what drew them to each other in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so when I can connect with their story, their hopes, their dreams, their mutual vision of what their family will look like one day, that's really, and maybe it's not even as like, well, I want one kid and you want four kids. Like, it's not even that. It's like, we want to be parents. And this was part of the deal when we got together, is we both really wanted this and we both still want it. We just have different experiences of this process, maybe different layers of self-protection, different abilities to express our needs, which I think sometimes like men and women are conditioned differently in terms of articulating pain and suffering. And so it's really getting people back on the same page in terms of who they are and what they want, and then starting to tease out those thoughts and feelings that are then driving their actions and their results in the world. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh. How long does that take? I'm just thinking on a functional, like, okay, how do I do this in my practice? And I'm thinking like, okay, I get 30 minutes for a new visit, a new patient visit. And, you know, a decent chunk of that is, here's, give me your medical history and here's the stuff that we need to do. And anytime you start asking those deeper questions, there are things that if someone can answer right away, it's great. But those are thought-provoking questions.
Yeah.
It's hard to answer. Yeah. You know, within seconds they answer.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of it is when you first meet, establishing that rapport. And that's something that I really, I mean, I know you all know this, but I think that in terms of just really connecting and seeing the person of a couple in front of you for who they are, it's just in a snippet, like, you know, okay, you're both from Vermont. Fantastic. I kind of understand you a little differently than, oh, we're transplants from Manhattan. Like, that's a very different patient encounter right there, you know? I mean, that's a stereotype, but it just is, right? And so just trying to understand who they are in a nutshell, what they do in their free time, like, literally takes less than 2 minutes. But then I'm like, okay, I kind of have an idea of who you guys are. And then it comes up again when things are not going well. So the first sign of things not going well is either bad news at the first appointment back, or say it's been mostly good news, but the initial treatments haven't worked. That's when those values-based questions really start to come up. And that's when people being on different pages and conflict really starts to come up. And this is one reason I love seeing couples, is because I think the body language is so telling. Like, we all know when people are like, turned towards each other,
they're leaning forward, on top of each other.
Holding hands, one person starts to cry, the other one offers them a tissue. Like, those are all really encouraging signs. But there are times when people are like, truly facing in opposite directions and their backs to each other, or their like arms are crossed. And it's like reading that body language and understanding, okay, what is behind that? Is it fear that this isn't going to work? Is this, you know, what is going on? Maybe it's even another family member that's putting pressure on the whole situation. We just don't know until we ask those questions. And so that's when I find it makes sense to explore that more. And if I get to the end of the appointment, because I'm not going to like, you know, spend time that I don't have, but if I get to the end of the appointment, I'm like, oh, I think we actually need to talk about this in more detail. Why don't we set up a 30-minute appointment that is just to tease out your, like, this is the information I want you guys to talk about it, you know, among yourselves. So I give them homework to do. And then we come back and I'm like, okay, so now we're going to talk about mindset and values and goals. And like, within that framework, what's the right thing for you guys? Mm-hmm. And so that's how I do it. Sometimes I have, and thankfully we can bill based on time in the medical, you know, office. I'm in coaching, I have all the time I need, right? So that's a really nice thing. But in terms of the medical, you know, office, that's what I'd recommend, to just like give them homework and then come back and really just say, this is a talking appointment about sort of how we can move forward.
What do you find when people are dealing with fertility challenges outside of kind of their partner relationship? What are some of your best ways of dealing with either people who don't understand or people who completely disagree with what they're doing when they're seeking fertility care?
Oh, that's a great question. So I think, you know, loving flexible boundaries is another one of our content pillars that we talk about at Love and Science. And so I think it really depends on the relationship. Sometimes we actually have to put real limits on our interactions with another person if we're going through something and they're not supportive of what we're trying to do. And it's just like, I think of Glennon Doyle, who I adore, on her podcast, she talks about like, this is our island. And these are the people we're inviting onto our island during this hard point in our lives. And, you know, you just might not get an invitation if you're not supportive. Like, unless you can be fully supportive of this endeavor, you're going to stay on your own side of the water, right?
But I love you, but you need to stay on your island.
Yeah. That's right. And then, like, you know, if you show your support and wholeheartedly, you know, can get on board with this, like, maybe we'll put down the drawbridge. Maybe you can row your boat, but then you might have an invitation. But it's a very, like, protective thing, right? Because we only have so many resources emotionally, and sort of dealing with a person who's not being supportive and can't be supportive, we might have to distance ourselves or put real limits on those conversations, which is sad. But at the end of the day, you know, we have to really connect with our values and do what's best for us. And that, I think that's amplified during the holidays. We talk about that a lot too. And even like Mother's Day, Halloween, like all those other like more subtle holidays that are really triggering that people may not think of too. So I just try to be as sensitive as possible and just to kind of like prep my patients and my clients and be like, okay, so you know, this is going to happen. Like, what is your response going to be? Or maybe somebody decides to like go to the Christmas party, but they're going to like stay for an hour and then leave because they know that's all they really want to handle that time. So, you know, I think a lot can happen in the preparation phases and sort of being very intentional about those relationships. And it might even be saying to somebody like, I love you dearly, and this is just a really hard time for me. And so, you know, I hope that you respect my need for space right now. And so in that way, being very loving about it, but also figuring out what we need and moving forward in that direction.
Mm-hmm. How can you help patients kind of figure out how much to disclose to find those people for the island? You know, because, you know, this is obviously a really stressful time. People sometimes are really embarrassed. They want to keep it under wraps. But, you know, I do think there's benefit in sharing with the right people. But the problem is trying to figure out who those right people are. What are some ways that people can kind of figure out, you know, who really can be trusted and who can't?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think of it like the toe in the water. So maybe if somebody says, oh, you guys got married, you know, a year ago, when are the babies going to come? That's like a common question.
Yeah.
You know, some people say, oh, we're working on it. Or, you know, other people might say, you know, it's been taking a little longer than we expected. And so, you know, can you pray for us? Or can you, you know, just put some good energy into the universe?
Yeah.
And then that almost like that shares a little bit vulnerably, but not like, oh, we've done 3 IVF cycles. That's not
Yeah.
And then based on that response, then, you know, somebody can then, you know, kind of figure out if they want to share more, if that's the right time or place. And I also think that we need to help our patients be very clear, because sometimes once a patient or a client will say to a family member, oh, I'm going through this, people don't know what to say, and then they don't ask about
it. They don't say anything. So, yeah.
So I try, you know, if there is that bridge that's been established that people know, you know, I actually tell my patients and clients to preempt that by saying, hey, I know I'm going to see you at the holiday party. Like, I'd really rather not just discuss the fertility stuff right now, if that's okay with you. Or like, you know, I just want you to know it's okay to ask me about this. Like, I really could use some extra support. And I think you're one of the only people who might understand. So it's, you know, I think it's really interesting to think about those things.
Erica, you had mentioned that you, you know, you really specialize in professional women and female physicians and in kind of that arena. What types of advice do you give for managing this and bosses, workplace, all that kind of stuff, like the demands of going back and forth and sharing and not sharing and all that?
It seems like physicians have it the hardest of anybody else. Everybody expects us to be on all the time, and we don't get to be sick or depressed or sad. So that's another layer, I think, that's challenging.
100%. And we talk about this a lot. I think, you know, say, you know, 1 in 4 female physicians has infertility. We know this data, and it's probably 1 in 6 or 7 of women.
Well, it's two out of three in our group.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I think your mission of empowering patients and giving people the tools and the knowledge that they need is just so, so laudable. And I'm so grateful for the work that you guys do. And I think sometimes, you know, we call it the wounded healer. Sometimes where we've been wounded ourselves is where we can heal the most. So I think
that's really touches
me. So your question was about, I kind of lost it too. Remind me your question.
So how best to address like being a professional
and dealing with
fertility and talking to your boss and managing work issues and coworkers who are like, why are you not showing up every morning until 9 o'clock? Blah, 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 blah.
Yes. So I think it depends on the exact situation. I mean, some people have more leverage than others in terms of like having time. You know, everyone has different levels of PTO and all those sorts of things. I think it's okay to be very general. to say, like, I have something medical going on and I'm going to need some flexibility and some cross coverage. Kind of like I did in my divorce. I was like, hey, I'm going to have a really unpredictable schedule for a while. Like, you know, you get a court date and then you got to show up on a Tuesday, you know, people were gracious. So not that I went into all those details. I think it's very similar. It's like, I'm going to need some flexibility and support. I really can't go into all the details. I appreciate you're respecting my privacy here, but you know, it's I'm going through some stuff right now and I'd really appreciate it. And I think that sometimes works really well. Or like there's creative ways. If you work nights, you know, and then you can come in at the end of your night shift, that can work for some people. And also, you know, just being a good citizen saying like, I'm going through this right now. I really appreciate some flexibility. You know, I will pay it back as I can, you know, just, I think there's like, you know, this sort of giving and receiving. I think that if we all believe that it's this cycle of community, I think it tends to go a lot better. So, mm-hmm. I mean, some people have a boss who's been through IVF or infertility, which is fantastic because they just get it. And it's like, hey, you know, you've been open about this. This is what's going on. And they're like, okay, no questions asked. You've got it. That's like best case scenario. But I think mm-hmm. if it's a little bit different, looking for creative solutions and also not necessarily saying everything, but just saying enough for vagueness. I always say, if this isn't appendicitis, they'd be out for 2 weeks. So, you know, I think we just have to change our mindset. IVF takes 2 weeks. It really does. We just got to think about how we can be creative in that way. And with my physician clients and patients, just understanding that like we are human beings too. Mm-hmm. And so
that's right.
I deserve medical care. Why would I not be able to take this time? And that's mm-hmm. a really hard sell sometimes. Like we don't naturally think this way. We need to support each other in community. But really we all are patients sometimes. It's just what form that's going to take. And so just normalizing that and giving ourselves permission to do what we need to do for ourselves when we need it.
I think the other layer of that too is a lot of people that go through fertility treatment, and I was in the same situation, are really early in their career. And even though you may be in your early to mid 30s, you're early in your career. You're still the low man on the totem pole, and you could still potentially be a resident or a fellow. And so it's really hard to go through that when you're the low person on the totem pole and everybody else is more senior. But I think as you get older, you realize kind of like what you said, I mean, I'm entitled to take time off too. I'm entitled to have medical illness and you really just need to be brave enough to say, look, I need this time and I'm sorry it's happening now. I'm sorry it's affecting your call schedule, but you know, I'm sorry. I got to do it.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Well, Erica, any last thoughts for our listeners today?
Oh my goodness. So I know we talked about maybe talking about relationships and sexual health. That's a whole other conversation. And so if you ever wanted to have me back, we could delve into that too, because I think that whole sexual health, obligatory functional timed intercourse is like my least favorite expression ever. So I'd love to go into that at some other point, but I think just know that you're not alone. And, you know, if you're listening to this podcast and you just feel like nobody else gets it, you know, that is just, it's not true. And I think listening to this podcast is very validating in that way. And I think getting real answers is so helpful. And various communities exist. We don't heal just individually, we heal collectively. And so whether it's a local support group or whether it's going to my website and seeing what our support group's about, you know, with me, find your people, because I think sometimes in relationships, especially, we get in trouble when we expect one other person to meet all of our needs. So maybe it's like our spouse or our best friend. And sometimes it just feels like too much, but the more we can cultivate our tribe of people who really understand and kind of spread the wealth, so to speak, I think not only do we feel more supported, but then we actually figure out how to take care of ourselves too, and then pay it forward and give to other people. And it makes everything better all the way around. So I would say, find your community, find your people. It reduces the shame. And when we can all connect with each other, that's when the really real healing happens.
That's amazing. That's awesome. Beautiful thought. And if anyone is wanting to contact Dr. Erica Bove, her website is loveandsciencefertility.com. And you can go there and there's links to make consultations and appointments and learn a little bit more about what she does on a daily basis. So to our audience, thank you for listening and be sure to tune in next week for more. Also be sure to subscribe and leave us a review in Apple Podcasts. If you've subscribed before, make sure you're still subscribing because Apple does all kinds of fun things nowadays. I would love to hear from you. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. So be sure to follow and subscribe and stay updated on all things fertility.
You can also visit us on fertilitydocsuncensored.com to submit specific questions. All questions will be answered on our podcast anonymously. for the Ask the Docs segment. Leave us some ideas for shows. We'd really love to hear from you.
As always, this podcast is intended for entertainment and is not a substitute for medical advice from your own physician. All right, we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Fertility is complex, and while there's a lot we can't control in the journey to parenthood, nutrition is a big one that both partners can. This is why we've teamed up with Needed, a perinatal nutrition company that optimizes nutrition for both partners throughout all stages of pregnancy. They offer a variety of products to support women and their partners on their journey to conception, including their fertility support for two plan. Support your body with radically better nutrition and save 20% off with your first month at thisisneeded.com with code FDU.